I'm going to read from the same chapter, Canto 3, Chapter 7. There's one more verse spoken by Vidura. In response to what Maitreya has said, and then there's a whole series of more questions going up to text 29. To text 20 through 29. Text 20 begins further elaborating or clarifying the that portion of people that are in between the like animals and the Paramahansas. Those persons are weak or alpa in their performance of austerity. Alpa tapasam. And because of that, it's difficult, or they can hardly obtain the service of the pure devotees who are progressing on the path back to the kingdom of Godhead, the Vaikunthas. So it's kind of backtracking. It's association with those great personalities. And in their company, hearing spiritual topics. That can change a fallen person into a recipient of mercy. Fortunate, an unfortunate to a fortunate person. And this verse is emphasizing, Vidura is emphasizing why it's difficult for them to take that association of saintly persons, because they're very weak in austerities. For those who are impersonalists, their regimen of austerities is severe. The standard of austerities that most people are unable to perform. In extreme circumstances, immersed in water up to the neck in the middle of the winter. There's a picture book that the devotees, in one place they have a restaurant, so they have a picture book and they show yogis doing different things, standing on their head and, you know, twisted like a pretzel. And another one is a yogi with his beard floating on the surface of the water, and he's in Gangotri, and, you know, there's ice cubes everywhere, like big ice blocks and ice, and he's in ice water up to his neck, just his face showing and his beard floating. That's one thing to take a cold bath. It's another thing to immerse your body up to your neck in ice-cold water. Just meditate. Meditate. Meditate on how cold it is. Or in the middle of the summer, build a ring of fire. And sit in the middle of the ring of fire and meditate on how hot it is. Then another page is a yogi who's lying on a big cactus slab that has pointers like that. And he's lying on his cactus slab meditating. how it hurts to have those cactus things poking in his body, etc. The idea, I suppose, is to withdraw one's consciousness from pain and identify with Brahman instead of pain. Even if one could do such a thing, it doesn't remove the tendency to desire sense gratification. Prabhupada gives this example of you have a bamboo forest and you do a little fire thing, so all the brush at the bottom is burned, all the weeds and whatever other than the bamboo shoots, everything is gone. And then some rain comes. Because the roots are there, the weeds can resume growing. Specifically, he's describing the process of prayaschitta, where counteraction for one's past misdeeds, past sins, is neutralized, supposing it can be effectively neutralized. Still, the root tendency still is there. And same for extreme austerity. Austerity or extreme austerity. Root tendency remains. I want to enjoy. And so knowing that, you know, that the teaching is that desire is the root of all evil, so they want to like get rid of desire. Just, you know, desire for sense gratification. So go the opposite direction, just deprive the senses. Or, you know, Monavrata is another one. So when they're done with their Monavrata, they it's not like the tendency to speak is gone. Or even while Monavrata, they carry a chalkboard to write on a chalkboard. So our process, the Bhagavad Marg process, is not that. But there, in the Bhagavad Marg process, there is a role in tapasya. And tapasya means voluntarily restricting. And so we have our basic four regular principles. That's for modern people, that's tapasya. Prabhupada liked to speak about Lord Zetland, formerly somehow involved during the British rule in Bengal. He had some other title in Bengal, and when he returned, it became Lord Zetland, some governmental rule. So he had some fondness of Indian culture. So when Bhaktisiddhanta's disciples went to England, they met with him, and he asked, "Can you make me a Brahmin?" And they said, "Sure, just follow these four restrictions." And his answer was, you know what his answer was? Impossible. Because the life of materialism is, those are foundational, you can't do without them, items. No tea drinking for a British man, etc. Not possible. Certainly possible. It's just, you know, what you, so for two other Bhagavatam verses, both of which come later in the Bhagavatam. Tapasya brahmacharjena samena cha namena tamena cha tyagena satya sochavyam namena niyamena va. Prabhupada calls that verse the regulative principles of knowledge. It's what is needed for someone who's on the path of advancing in knowledge, this, the entry point is tapasya. And the first item on the tapasya list is brahmacharya. There's no question of brahmacharya. There's no question of being a focused student if the student is not following brahmacharya principle. No question. That's not the standard in modern society. This is a little anecdote that just someone brought to my attention from America today. This is like surprising. This is not what the standard is. The standard is unrestricted sense gratification. There's the Mormons, the Mormon faith. You're familiar with that? Yes? No? No? Mormon faith. One of the fastest growing Christian denominations in the world. Just a little history. Something in America, there was one of the pilgrims or early settlers from Europe was with a group of other Christians, and they were in the western part of New York State, a place called Palmyra, doesn't matter. And he was with his group of pilgrims. He went up a mountain and God spoke to him. And he came back down the mountain and told what God had spoke to him. And those things that God spoke to him, really, it's a Christian denomination, but it's they're very strict in certain ways. And later they migrated west and they settled in the state of Utah, U-T-A-H. And the whole state is Mormons. And they have rules like in order to be a Mormon in good standing, and that means in order to get marriage in a Mormon church, you have to give something, some portion, tithing, like 10% of your gross income before taxes, you must give it to the church. And they're very family-based in their practice and their the teachings and their practice. So it's popular. People want to see strong families, and they teach strong families, and they follow it. So it's growing. They have a policy that if you're a good Mormon in good standing, when you're 20 to 22 years of age, 2 years, you just take out of college or whatever you're doing in life and you dedicate fully to missionary work. So the world has lots of Mormons traveling around doing missionary work at that prime stage of life. And then if you do that, then the church will take care of the balance of your education, because they have all this funding, so they take care of the persons that do their missionary work. And one of their rules is no premarital sex, principles. And they have a university in Utah called Brigham Young University. Brigham Young was one of the earlier followers of the Mormon faith that really got the thing going in Utah. So there's a college, Brigham Young University. So one of their leading athletes, they were like, top in the competition in basketball, and second year student had a sexual encounter with his girlfriend. So he resigned from the basketball team. It was like a big thing in America. One of the leading teams. But, so the school's response was, it's not a matter of what's right or wrong, it's a matter of commitment, and we have this code of honor that you won't do such things. You know, because in their religion it's considered a sin. It's considered like violation of the four regular principles, or one of the regular principles. And if you violate it, you're not to accept certain something or others. I don't know what their policy is, but the code of honor, if you violate it, what happens? But in his case, he just resigned from the basketball team. So the whole country's going, wow, that's like, you know, impossible. So there is some vestiges here and there of people that really hold that value important. But for the most part, that was a little deviation. The most part is the age of Kali. It's not considered. It's animal life. So, tapo divyam. There's another verse. Putrakayena satvam shudyat. This is Rishabhdev's teachings from the fifth canto. That other one is from the sixth canto. Tapasya brahmacharjina. That's Shukadev Goswami speaking to Maharaj Prikshit. When Maharaj Prikshit wants to know what can be done to counter the sins that people perform so that they don't have to go to the hellish planets and experience what he heard in the fifth canto. Description of the hellish planets. So karmakanda is first offered. You do prayaschitta. So it's not sufficient. The tendency still remains. And what about knowledge? If you know better, then maybe you won't do it. But even if you know better, still people do things they shouldn't do, even though they know better. So that's the same. Even there's tapasya, it's not sufficient. Tendency still remains. Like Ajamila, he was a nice Brahmin, and he was observing the principles of Brahminical life, but he became overwhelmed. And gave up his Brahminical life. So, counteracting is not sufficient. Karmakanda is not sufficient. Jnana is not sufficient. Even on the path of bhakti, just like, so now this is the fifth canto verse. Here this is third canto. But amplifying the same point made in the third canto by Vidura to Maitreya is Rishabhdev making the point to his 100 sons. You know that verse which says, Nayam deha deha bhajam raloke kastan kaman arate vidhujami. Don't live your life like animals. Vidhujami, like the stool eating hogs, where sense gratification is the name of the game or the principle that you pursue in life. Don't live your life that way. Rather, tapo divyam. Putraka. So, my dear sons, follow this principle of divine austerity, not just austerity for the sake of austerity, like, you know, immersing yourself in water. So we don't do those things. In freezing water. And it's not just austere yogis or impersonalists that do that. When I was small, young, growing up, I lived by a lake in a climate that the lake would freeze in the winter. And there was a man, very well-known person, that as soon as the ice would thaw, it's still like freezing, but he would go swimming. And everyone thought, you know, wow, this guy's either crazy or, you know, or like really intense or something. But it was like every year. So invigorating. It was what he would say. He was like invigorated. There must be something to it, because otherwise how can yogis do it? There's some way that they're sustaining body heat. They can't do it otherwise. They just become an ice cube. I mean, literally, they would, their blood would freeze. Because it's also water. It would freeze. They have to have some way of maintaining body heat. So, there, anyway, we're all going there. Divine austerity is for the purpose of realization of the soul different than the body and realization of the supreme soul. That's tapo divyam. Like, for example, we're not, Prabhupada would say, we're not a vegetarian society. We're a Krishna conscious society. And the reason that we observe this principle of no meat, fish, or eggs is we only take Krishna prasadam. We can't offer those things to Krishna, so we're Krishnatarians, not vegetarians. We only take Krishna prasadam. It's for that purpose, because we want to please Krishna. And subset, or built within it, is we're vegetarian. So we don't promote vegetarianism. We can, as a method, we can, of reaching communities of people, we can invite them to vegetarian cooking classes. But what we do is explain that not only that, you have to offer your food to Krishna. If we want people to become Krishna conscious, not just giraffes and water buffalo. They're also vegetarian. So is a hippopotamus. It's vegetarian. An elephant's vegetarian. So they're big and strong. So you want to be big and strong, be a hippopotamus. So tapo divyam, shuddhya, it's for the purpose of purification, of consciousness. That the verse is describing, Vidura is describing, the difficulty of those that are alpa medasam, they're very, alpa tapasam, they're weak in the capacity of tapasya. But then Prabhupada turns right around, just as Prabhupada does in the purport here, and say, addressing his audience, all of you, your American, European boys and girls, before you practiced Krishna consciousness, you were like Lord Zeppelin, where it was impossible. But just by hearing and chanting and performing devotional activities, now you're completely changed in your habits. Those things are disgusting to you. At least the vegetarian, the non-vegetarian thing. And so that the Bhagavat Marg process is emphasis upon hearing and chanting as a means to create that necessary capacity for austerity, or increase the little tendency for austerity. Noting that we speak first to people about the message before we start speaking to people about the do's and the don'ts. That's how Prabhupada started the Hare Krishna movement in the West. He didn't right away saying, here's the regular principles, and admonish his students for their bad habits, or smoking, or other, kinds of bad habits. He didn't go there. He just gave them prasadam, and gave them in kirtan, and spoke some from Bhagavad Gita. That was my first experience with Srila Prabhupada in college that I attended. He didn't speak about regular principles. And in the public setting, certainly at the little preaching center, they were following. And after time, the capacity for austerity, tapo divyam, becomes possible. So here's what Prabhupada says. The path of liberation, as recommended by all authorities, is to serve the Mahatma transcendentalists. That's also in Rishabhdev's teachings. Does anyone know that verse? Mahatsevam dvaram ahor vimuktes. As far as Bhagavad Gita is concerned, the Mahatmas are the pure devotees who are on the path to Vaikuntha, the kingdom of God, and who always chant and hear the glories of the Lord rather than talk of dry, profitless philosophy. The system of association has been recommended since time immemorial. But in this age of quarrel and hypocrisy, it is especially recommended by Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, even if one has no assets of favorable austerity, if he nevertheless takes shelter of the Mahatmas who are engaged in chanting and hearing the glories of the Lord, he's sure to make progress on the path back home, back to Godhead. Prabhupada makes it sound so easy, right? And it is, compared to these other very, very austere processes, so austere that no question of being able to follow them. I shared this in Hyderabad, and I'll share it with you. Nice. One of the impersonal messages is, if it's specific Shankaracharya, at least the followers of Shankaracharya, I don't know what he said, that's what their present program is. They say there's no question of making any spiritual progress unless you take sannyas. It's like the three levels mentioned in the 13th chapter of the first canto, where Vidura is advising Dhritarashtra, get out of here. So Dhira, Sannyas, and Narottama, those three stages of detachment. How can you advance spiritually if you're attached? There has to be some level of detachment, and there's differing degrees or levels of detachment. And one is like frustration. That was about the best that Dhritarashtra could accomplish. Or sannyas, specifically Parivrajakacharya, traveling here and there, taking the message of Krishna to others. And Paramahamsa is the topmost stage, where there is, it's not just a service, it's one's total absorption. As in Madhavendra Puri, he was on that platform. So, one time I was traveling from, this is like maybe 4 years ago, something, traveling from Delhi to Hyderabad in January. And so there's two things. At that time, all the flights were all scheduled at the same time. Right? I mean, because it's catering to business people that had to get to another city and do business and then come back at night. So the flights would all leave around 6 o'clock. So the airport was jammed at 6 o'clock, or for the 6 o'clock to 7 o'clock departures. Another thing is in January, there's fog in Delhi because the day is warm, at night it's very cold, and because it's cold, the air temperature and the land temperature are so different that there's fog. And then none of the planes can leave when there's fog. So you have the airport is double jammed. It's like all the people who want to leave at the same time and nobody leaves. And then a third thing, those of you, you all know this, In India, nobody stands in line. Everybody, like, there's a counter, and there's 50 people all trying to do the same thing at the same time, and in one spot. It's a cultural thing, I don't know. So everybody trying to check in their luggage at the counter, and everybody's got their luggage jammed into the person's back right in front of them, and they don't like this. It was bedlam. And then, you know, and all the flights going at the same time. This is before they have the, like, their new terminal, two terminals, or, you know, it's a little more organized now. So after, I don't know, 45 minutes of standing in line to check my luggage in, then comes security. And the lines were like as long as a football field. And, you know, three or four lines. So there was one person in the line ahead of me, and everyone's looking at their watch because their flight's going to leave, but it's not going to leave because it's, you know, so the waiting room is just jammed. It's not going to leave because there's fog. It's total chaos, in other words, get the picture. So there was a person in line in front of me, and the parallel line, like, you know, up ahead, and his line was moving and my line was not moving. And he kept looking back. And, you know, realized after some time he was looking at me like the white elephant standing in the line. And finally, after he got through security, I got through security, and he sat down and he put his stuff in a chair by his side so that, you know, when people said, "Is anybody sitting there?" he'd say, "Yes." He was saving the seat for me so that I could sit down. And as soon as I sat down, he motioned me over and he said, because the flights aren't leaving, it's all this fog. He said, "Are you part of a religious organization?" "Well, yeah, yeah." And he asked, "What is that organization?" I said, "ISKCON." He said, "Oh, I've been to an ISKCON center from Bombay." Then his question was, is it true that unless you're a sannyasi, you can't make any spiritual advancement?" And I said, "What are you talking about?" And he said, "Well, I have been to Sringeri, and that's what they say. And I'm married, and I'm very confused. Am I supposed to give up my wife? And I don't think that would be so good, but I want to make spiritual advancement." And he was, you know, like, was spun out. Sincerely asking, and a little confused. So we went through some rudimentary things of Bhagavad Gita, you know, look at Arjuna, or look at Vyasadeva, or, you know, look at the such elevated personalities who are, even Krishna. You know, it's not Krishna. Arjuna is saying, I'm ready to renounce, and Krishna is saying no. And does that mean he's saying, "No, I don't want you to make spiritual advancement"? Where's this idea come from? It's a concoction. What is necessary is, so we went through Rupa Goswami's Pagva Vairagya and detachment that comes from Yukta Vairagya, that comes from engaging things in Krishna service. And I describe what Lord Chaitanya's teaching is, that what qualifies one to not see objects as objects of sense gratification, but as the property of Krishna to be engaged in Krishna service. That's how a grihastha has to see things. Not only wife, but your job and money that comes from your job and all things. This is the property of Krishna, and I'm simply serving Krishna. So he was listening carefully. He wasn't objecting or whatever. And just at that time, a devotee couple that are from Hyderabad and their small son were also going to Hyderabad from Delhi. And they came right at the right moment. Krishna sent them. And they had their tilak on, they had their bead bags, and, you know, the son had bead bag and tilak, and they all came up and paid a base. "Oh, Maharaj, paid obeisances." And they said, "Look, there's an example. It's not just there's the precept, there's the example. Here's how you can make spiritual advancement as a grihastha they're living lives of dedicating all things to Krishna's services. Look at them. Now I just look at them. I'm going to give my seat to them. They can sit here and tell you how it works. And, you know, next time when you come back, you can visit the ISKCON Center. And, so I don't know what happened after that. At least his inquiry made, by his inquiry, Krishna made some arrangements so he could have an alternative to this idea that restraint of the senses is necessary if one wants to progress in spiritual life. But then it's not just the turtle that withdraws his limbs, the turtle can also extend his limbs. And when there's some service, then one can extend one's limbs and do some service. That's the platform of bhakti. And otherwise, the capacity for withdrawing the senses must also be part of the repertoire of the devotee. So the emphasis in the verse, it looks like I'm not going to get to the other. Text 21 through 29, we'll do that tomorrow. Pure devotees engage 100% in glorifying the Supreme Lord, who is the Lord of the demigods and the controller of all living entities. So that's just icing on the cake. It's just further glorification of the value of pure devotees' association. So there's the pure devotee, there's the animal-like person, and there's everybody in between. The merit of that association is so advantageous, so wonderful. It can help the persons who are in that middle zone and a little weak become strong through that association. And what makes them strong? They're worshiping, hearing, chanting, glorifying the Supreme Lord, who is the Lord of Lords. He's the Lord of the demigods. And he's the controller of all controllers. He's the Supreme, and they're not mistaken about it. They're clear about it, and their activity is focused upon that person. Their messages are always focused upon that person. Their association is so much valued. Hare Krishna. Wait to hear the verses that I didn't read. It's all very technical stuff about the Purushas and Virabhrupa and those kind of things. Any questions? Okay. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada.